out and nominated his economic team. So he picked Larry Summers to head the National Economic Council. That's the top economist in the entire administration. Larry Summers was the president of Harvard, got himself into a lot of trouble a year ago because he said something that he shouldn't have said. Larry Summers, by many, is considered maybe the smartest economist out there. He's worked under two or three different administrations already. He's definitely worked under Clinton. He's a really, really smart guy. So Larry Summers is somebody you'd want to think about economics. Christina Romer, what the Council of Economic Advisors does, it's a bunch of academic economists, people like me. You have to have a U.S. passport in order to serve on it, and there's always one person heading up the whole thing. So Christina Romer, who's a professor in the economics department, anybody here had a class with Christina Romer? How good is she as a teacher, right? She's amazing. So they basically, the White House will come in and ask them to analyze, for example, changes to the Endangered Species Act, what are the consequences on the welfare of people living in these areas. Then one of the staff economists will get working, crank some numbers, come back with a recommendation. Christina Romer would go to the White House and present that to either the president direct or his staffer. So what you would want in somebody who runs the council is you want somebody who really has a broad understanding of the major economy. So Christina's main expertise is in the Great Depression and business cycles. So those are two really important issues right now. She's jointly with her husband on the board that declare whether the U.S. is in a recession or not. So she knows this stuff inside out. She knows economic history. She knows macro. And I think what's really smart about this pick is she's one of Sharkey's best teachers. So she can take incredibly complicated material and convey it to undergraduate students. Now, most undergraduate students have a better understanding of economics than many policymakers. So you really need to be sure that you have somebody who can take really complicated material, make up their mind, and then be able to convey it in a way that somebody who doesn't have a PhD in economics can understand. So I think those two appointments are really good choices. This is purely subjective. You may disagree with me, but that's just me. We'll see what happens with the rest. The one I really am curious about is who's going to run the Environmental Protection Agency, but I've got $20 down on somebody, so we'll see what happens. All right, this is what we do in environmental economics. We bet on who runs the EPA. Okay. So from an economist's perspective, I think those are good choices. But let's talk about the environment. So where are we? So last time, the last two sort of lectures, we started talking about market failures. What happens in settings where the markets aren't perfectly competitive and there are sort of violations of the assumptions underlying the perfectly competitive model, and we leave the market alone? So the first violation we had was the one of market power, where we said, well, what if a firm is the only firm in the market and therefore gets to set price? So this assumption that firms are price takers is violated. So we showed that the monopolist will set price at a higher level than the perfectly competitive outcome would, and would produce less than the perfectly competitive market. We showed that there's dead weight loss, and therefore there's inefficiencies coming from having monopolists produce the output in the market. We also concluded that the monopolist is not an intrinsically evil firm, but just a profit-maximizing firm, and it's rational for him or her to produce at this level where marginal revenue equals marginal cost. So we had a nice model showing that monopolists are bad for society. Then we had the so-called toothpaste model, where we showed that if you have firms that act like monopolists, but in markets for goods where there are called substitutes, right? So toothpaste, you're the only one producing Colgate Minty Freshness. Nobody else gets to produce Colgate Minty Freshness, but people could produce Crest Minty Freshness. So there are no called substitutes. So this model of monopolistic competition, we showed that if firms can successfully product differentiate their product, meaning convince you that your product is different from their competitors, they will also, in the short run, gain some positive economic profits, but as people produce closer and closer substitutes, those profits go away. But in equilibrium, still, they're going to charge a price higher than marginal cost, which results in deadweight loss, even if they're not getting any positive profit. So those are the two market failures that we've studied. Now, remaining time, we're going to study three more. Right? Today, we're going to look at externalities, which is what Kalanit and I earn our daily living with, which is basically looking at this idea that firms may engage in activities where the full cost of their activity isn't actually borne by the firm. All right? So, more generally speaking, market failure number two, you could call it number three, but I always bunch monopoly and monopolistic competition into the same market failure. So market failure number two here, I'm going to call externalities. And this is a very basic term, but just to make sure that we're all on the same page, the way any economist thinks about the word externality when you use it is as follows. So it's either a cost or a benefit that arises from an activity which does not accrue to the person or organization carrying out the activity. That's beautifully phrased. I could never say it like that if I tried. But that doesn't necessarily mean that one understands what that means. Okay? So the idea is that if you translate this into regular English, that how well off you are as a consumer or how able a firm is to produce its output, those things are directly affected by actions of other consumers or other firms. So what this means is one firm may be negatively affected by another firm's production activity. So if you have a dirty paper mill upstream from a fishery, the paper mill's reuse of river water in order to put the bleach and stuff into the river water negatively affects the fisherman's ability to profitably catch fish downstream. Or if you have a power plant at the Grand Canyon, the power plant, one of the biggest coal-fired power plants is right at the Grand Canyon. Haze, sort of smoke comes out of this power plant, and the haze that is formed by that smoke affects the visibility at the Grand Canyon, therefore everybody and all the germ tourists that go to the Grand Canyon, they're all worried about not being able to see the other side, you know? So you go and there's haze everywhere, and so because the firm doesn't pay for this, the use of clean air, there's some issue where their production activity affects other people's well-being or other firms' ability to profitably what it is they want to do, and we're going to look at whether that's efficient or not. So, since it is the lecture before Thanksgiving, I thought we'd start easy and then get a little bit, you know, more technical and then end on a very easy note again. So, externalities. I always thought they were just negative externalities, right? Sounds like a nasty word. Externality. Doesn't sound like something that, you know, so, an externality actually doesn't necessarily have to be negative or negative, right? It doesn't have to negatively affect others. So, it could also help others. So, if you have an externality that harms others, meaning imposes a cost on other firms or consumers, that's what we call a negative externality. So, I'll give you loads of examples of these. But negative externalities are things like pollution. That's the classical example, right? The coal-fired power plant imposes a negative externality on these germ tourists, or the paper mill imposes a negative externality on the fishery downstream. So bad things happen. There are also positive externalities. So a positive externality is if I do something, and for some reason my activity, what I find privately optimal, makes other people happier or better off. So you could think of an example, and this is the classic example that they always pull out in every undergraduate textbook, and I tried to be creative and come up with some other ones, so watch me. But positive externality, the example is always, if you're a beekeeper, right, you have a whole bunch of bees, and what, if you know how bees and this whole honey thing works, it's kind of complicated, but you can watch the Discovery Channel and it'll enlighten you. So there's an apple orchard next door. So what happens is the bees go over to the apple orchard, and something happens with the flowers, they come back, and all of a sudden there's honey. Right? So the fact that there's an apple orchard next door, so the beekeeper, the bees have a positive externality for the owner of the apple orchard, since they something happens to the flower and then you get apples, right? And then the other way around, because there are flowers on the apple trees next door to the beekeeper, the beekeeper gets honey because the stuff from the flowers or the apples or whatever gets carried over to the beekeeper, and then there's honey that you can sell for $8.99 at Whole Foods, which I found out to my great horror yesterday. All right? So that's an example of a positive externality. There are some things that may be both. So the key point here is what's a negative externality to some may be a positive externality to others. So my favorite example here are wind chimes. Alright? You know those things you go to Home Depot, you saw a whole bunch of copper tubes into little pieces like that, drill holes, hang it off a wooden plate, hang it outside your windows, and then when the wind blows through it, it's supposed to make soothing noises. So my wife happens to really like wind chimes. So when my neighbor put up a wind chime, she was really happy. I had visions of baseball bats and taking down that wind chime. It prevented me from sleeping. My cats were constantly at the window trying to get at the wind chime and destroyed the screen. It wasn't good. So to my wife, the wind chimes were a positive externality and very soothing. To me, they were a negative externality. So the point I want to make here is what's a positive and what's a negative externality, especially on the consumer side, depends on your preference. Right?
Yeah, how to, like, I know there's something that makes us,
yeah.
That global cooling.
Ah, yeah, I work on this stuff. So yeah, this is actually kind of a nice example. So if you drive your car, there's a lot of nasty stuff that comes out of tailpipes. One set of things that comes out of your tailpipe is something called aerosols. They're little fine particulates that cause coughs and asthma and all kinds of things. But when they form a layer, right? So like if you fly into Los Angeles, I flew into LA yesterday and it's still nasty, the air quality there. So if you fly and you see this layer of air pollution hanging over LA, what these layers actually do, and it's even more prevalent than in places like India or China, if you fly in there, you see this thick layer of soot. Well, what happens is sunlight hits that layer of soot and some of the sunlight gets reflected back into space. So instead of hitting the ground and being absorbed by the ground and warming the surface, this air pollution actually reflects sunlight back into space. And some estimates by some of my co-authors suggest that in places like India, for example, where these layers are really thick, these layers may have masked up to half the effects of global warming because you get less heating on the ground. So this air pollution actually causes some benefit from having lower global warming. Turns out it's a much more complicated issue, and we could spend lectures and lectures talking about this because it kills people on the ground, makes people sick, and so on. So we've got to look at the whole picture. But if we just look at the climate change effect, that you could look at that as a positive externality. If you did that in a courtroom, though, and you were on the other side, I could argue you to the ground that you were wrong. So don't get any funny ideas. All right? I don't want you to walk away at the Thanksgiving table and say my professor said that air pollution coming out of cars are a positive externality. Not necessarily true. One aspect of them is, but overall they're vastly negative. Okay. Question.
Could pollution be a positive externality for the people that make space masks or
Yeah, I have another example for you in a second. But it's basically anything, right? If you do something that you were going to do anyway, and there's some positive spillover effect for somebody else, that's considered a positive externality. So that's the general idea. But it has to be external to you. So another example here is Celine Dion, all right? I really can't stand Celine Dion. So my previous neighbor, not the one with the wind chimes, the one before that, really loved Celine Dion, and he would come home and he'd had a karaoke machine or not, I don't know. But the My Heart Will Go On song was playing forever. Drove me nuts. But the idea again is if you have a neighbor that likes Celine Dion, it could be a positive externality for you if you happen to like her music. For me, it was a very negative externality since it made me really angry. And then the guy with the wind chimes moved in. I mean, I just can't win. Here, my colleague, Jeff Perloff, who's written one of the nicest textbooks in economics, I think, has this cartoon in his textbook. You could make an argument that environmental destruction has a positive spillover effect or positive externality effect for some. If we chop down all the trees, most of the allergens are gone, and you're really allergic to trees. You could argue that, you know, environmental destruction has positive effects for you. I usually think that these examples are rather sad. Okay, talk sports. I know nothing about sports. Now, a little bit about motor racing, but this type of sport I know nothing. But Michael Jordan, I even heard about him in Germany. He was a big basketball star, later baseball, and then again basketball, and then retired, I think. But the basic idea is, Michael Jordan, you could actually measure the effect of the positive externality that Michael Jordan created in dollar terms. So Michael Jordan, for those of you who are too young or don't remember, was maybe the greatest basketball player of all time. He played for Chicago and you know, had a whole line of basketball sneakers, but everybody knew who Jordan was, right? So the idea here is very simple. If you think about Michael Jordan coming into town, even if you have a crappy basketball team, like that Will Ferrell team in semi-pro, right, that nobody wants to go see, if all of a sudden the Chicago Bulls come into town, that stadium is going to sell out. Right? That stadium's going to sell out even though otherwise nobody else is ever going to watch this local team play. So Jordan's presence on the Chicago Bulls, some economists with a lot of data figured out that during 1991 and 1992, the regular season away games, ticket revenues were $2.5 million higher than in previous years when Michael Jordan wasn't on the team and years after when he left the Chicago Bulls. So you can sort of extract the effect of having Jordan on the team. As well as for local TV stations who show these games, advertising revenues went up by $2.4 million. So again, there's this positive spillover effect or positive externality that these extra revenues that Michael Jordan got no kickback from, right? He doesn't get a kickback from the TV stations or the local ticket vending place. So it's just something that the positive externality that he caused. Additional externalities here. So this person really went way overboard. But Jordan's presence in basketball overall made basketball a more popular sport, right? Same thing went for Formula One racing. You have the crazy car racing. You have a superstar like Michael Schumacher racing. Lots of people are going to watch it, and everybody wants to have a Ferrari shirt. If the guy retires, nobody cares. Okay, so superstars just have an effect for what happens to the sport overall. So this person argued that Michael Jordan's presence in the NBA overall increased TV advertising revenues by $6.6 million in a regular season and $13.9 million during the playoffs. I mean, these are significant sums right here. How much clothing, hats, and videos were sold, again, up by $15.1 million. So these revenues, national TV advertising, the hats and so on, this is all shared by all teams equally. So this stuff is sold and then spread out across teams equally. So all teams benefited from having Jordan play for the Chicago Bulls. So overall, Michael Jordan's positive externality in one season was $40.3 million. Right? Probably pretty close to his salary. I don't know what his salary was in the basketball. The nice little, what people like to say, well, this may be a fluke. There may have been something special about the 1991 season. What happens when he comes back? So He, I think, played baseball, right? And then he went back to playing basketball, or he played golf. I don't remember. Something like that happened. So he retired, came back, and played for the Washington Wizards, 2001, 2002, 2002, 2003. And again, you could see that ticket sales went up at away games, even though it was a not-so-good team, right? But just to see Michael Jordan play once, people would pay more money or attend these away games. So again, people think that ticket sales went up by 7% throughout the league, or $8 to $20 million of the overall revenue of the league. So having a superstar in the league creates this positive externality. Okay, so a cutesy example right here has to do with sports. Max knows nothing about sports. Max knows a lot about power plants. I couldn't find a picture. We went to visit a power plant out of picture. Hard hat standing on top of a power plant. It's totally ridiculous. But I have evidence that I've seen a power plant from the inside. So let's think of the following. Let's think of a power plant that produces electricity. Right? In California, most of the electricity is produced using natural gas. These power plants are incredibly efficient now, but no matter how clean we make them, there's still some air pollution that comes out. So let's assume that the market for power, for electricity, is competitive. Right? We could assume that the wholesale market for electricity is roughly competitive. It's not really, but let's just assume that it is. So many, many sellers and many, many buyers. So you have many power plants selling electricity into a market, and you have a whole bunch of utilities buying electricity in these wholesale markets. So what these firms do is they do two things. As they produce output, like all the firms that we've seen before. So they use labor and capital in order to produce units of electricity. Just like before, firms use labor and capital in order to produce, you know, mowed lawns or clean offices or something like that. For simplicity's sake, we're going to say, well, as they're producing this electricity, they're going to produce air pollution at the same time, which is a very reasonable assumption. So as you produce 1 kilowatt hour of electricity, you produce at the same time a couple of micrograms of particulate matter, which gives kids asthma and, you know, does all kinds of bad stuff, decreases visibility at the Grand Canyon. In order to make our life really, really simple, I'm going to assume that for each megawatt hour of power produced, I'm going to get one unit of pollution. It's a little bit more complicated than that because power plants run really hot. They get less efficient. Really, really hot days, power plants get less efficient, which also happens to be the days when demand is highest. So because it's not really like this in real life. It's a little bit more complicated than that. But let's just make our life simple and say you want to produce one unit of power, you produce one unit of air. Right? You can make it more complicated if you wish later. In addition, we're going to make our life very easy, and we're going to say the only way to decrease air pollution for this plant is to produce less output. In real life, you can do that, and a lot of plants do that, but you can do other things. If we're worried about sulfur pollution, for example, which was the stuff that was behind acid rain, you could install scrubbers. I don't know if anybody's ever seen a scrubber. Right? So fumes come out of a power plant. You spray, I think, limestone into the fumes, so sort of limey dust, and that collects the sulfur, and the stuff falls to the ground like this mushy, tasty, sandy stuff. You dry it, and you turn it into drywall, and then put it into your apartment building. How much do you think it costs for a power plant to install a scrubber? Any estimates?
$50,000.
$50,000. Wow, who said that? All right, way off.
$3 million.
$3 million, who said that? All right, way off.
$100 million.
$100 million, you're getting closer. All right, who said that? Up here. There you go, all right. It costs somewhere between $200 and $500 million to install a scrubber for a power plant. So for the really big ones, it's about $500 million to install a scrubber. These things are non-trivial expenses for power plants. So if you're sort of angry at your next door power plant, the Hunters Point power plant in San Francisco, for example, they should disrupt the pollution away. We're not talking about some sort of trivial capital investment. These are massive costs. But let's talk about this. So here I'm just going to assume that there are no scrubbers. We can build those into the model. And again, this makes it more complicated. Let's just assume the only way to decrease pollution is to decrease output. So one pollutant for which this is actually a valid assumption is greenhouse gases. The only way to get fewer carbon dioxide per ton of coal, per sort of unit of electricity produced from coal, is to actually produce less electricity. Unless you are somewhere like China or India, where there's a lot of boilers that don't get very hot because they're very old, you can still increase the thermal efficiency of boilers and get a little bit of decreases in pollution that way. But generally speaking, for CO2, the only way to decrease CO2 is to drive less or drive more efficient cars, or to decrease production of power or shift to a less carbon-intensive source of power. Okay, so let's talk about a distinction that we haven't really talked about so far. So far, firms have incurred costs of production. And so far we've said, as a firm increases the amount of power produced, its total costs of production go up. Right? We drew these nice short-run total cost curves that were like this sort of flipped-up S shape, had a total variable cost curve, which was shifted down by the amount of total fixed costs, and then we showed, you know, average variable and average total cost. Well, these costs we call total private costs. I'm going to now call total private costs. By private costs, I mean these are costs that the firm incurs and actually has to pay for out of pocket or in terms of opportunity costs. So it involves paying for the labor you hire. It involves paying for the capital that you rent or buy. It involves paying yourself for the time you could have spent somewhere else running the firm. So all of these private costs that the firm incurs, these costs we've talked about, those are called, I just said the private costs are called private costs, obviously. The costs we've talked about so far, they're called private costs. So labor, capital, coal, stuff like that, those are private costs. However, what we're now going to worry about is if we have externalities, your activity, meaning what you produce, or your power production stuff. I can't talk today. I went to LA yesterday. I'm pretty tired. But I'm going to try and not drive you crazy today. So the idea is your activities result in some sort of external costs imposed upon somebody else that you're not responsible for. So you, the power plant, pump particulate matter into the skies that falls down 3 miles down the road onto a school with small children in it. Those children get asthma or stay home from school sick because they can't breathe properly. And you as the firm right now are not responsible for paying for those costs. Right? So your activity imposes a cost upon other people that you're not actually paying for. Those costs I'm going to call external costs. So there are any costs you're imposing upon somebody else by your production activities and you not being responsible by them.
How would you calculate the cost of the example of a new analogous?
I'm going to talk about that in the end. It's hard. Right? That's how if I were to consult, that's how I could make a lot of money. But it's not trivial. But I'm going to hold off on that for about 20 minutes or so, and then I'll tell you. So social costs, meaning the total cost of your production activity, of you producing 100 megawatt hours of power, are whatever it costs you to buy coal, labor, capital, plus whatever the external costs are, meaning the costs that you impose upon a society by having kids miss school or kids being sick in the hospital or, you know, trees dying. Depends on what kind of externality you're talking about. So social costs are what we're worried about. In everything we've talked about so far, in the perfectly competitive model, there are no external costs. Therefore, private costs are social costs. So right before, when we talked about office cleaning and so on, we assumed that Society's cost of you running a firm, cleaning offices, simply costs society the amount you pay in labor, capital, and opportunity cost of your time. There were no external costs. Now we're adding in this notion that there's a set of firms that actually cost society money that they're not responsible for. So what I would like to show you now is why this is bad for society. What happens? So, what do you think happens intuitively? It's always what you should ask yourself before you start this stuff. So, if a plant produces power and at the same time produces pollution, do you think it produces too much if I leave it alone, or too little if I leave it alone? Probably too much, right? So, let's see what happens when we build this into our sort of basic supply and demand model. And see if we come up with a prediction where if I leave that firm alone, it'll produce too much pollution. So let's go ahead and try and figure this out. All right. So here's what we're going to do. So I'm going to say that there is some sort of demand curve for paper. All right? Or let's do power. Sorry. I was obsessed with paper mills last year. This year I'm obsessed with power plants. Power. In kilowatt hours. Okay, there's some aggregate demand for electricity or for power. That aggregate demand meets some aggregate supply curve. Alright? That aggregate supply curve, we know, is just the sum of individual firms' marginal cost curve. Right? So if I horizontally add all firms' marginal cost curves, I get some supply curve, and that, I'm going to put that in brackets, is the marginal cost aggregate marginal cost of production. And that's the private cost. So just to make sure we're clear on this, right? The supply curve, which I'm going to call it a marginal cost curve in a second, because it's easier to think about it that way. The supply curve is simply I take all power plants' marginal cost curve, I draw them next to each other, I add them horizontally, and I get some sort of flatter aggregate supply curve in this market. Right? My demand curve meets the supply curve and I get some sort of equilibrium quantity. Now this supply curve right here is what we've seen so far. It's just the sum of the private marginal cost curve. So, what's the equilibrium here? The equilibrium here is simply where the supply meets demand, and I get some equilibrium price for power and some equilibrium quantity of power produced. Right? Nothing new here. This is old. Here we go. You ready for it? This is exciting. I'm so excited about this. Alright, so now, as I add output, right, for each additional unit of output, these firms produce some sort of damage or impose some sort of damage upon society. So for one unit of output, I simply look at what the aggregate damage on society is from producing that much power using the curves I have. And I can figure out, assuming that I know what these damages are, which I'd love to tell you how economists actually get those, I could figure out what the so-called marginal social cost of producing power is. So by adding up the damages from each individual firm, I could figure out something as follows. it looks like this. So this is, I'm going to call this external marginal cost. That's if I produce, let's say, one unit of power. I am imposing a, if this number here is 4, a $4 cost on society from producing that first unit of power. All right? So just to make sure we're clear in our mind here. So if I want to produce that first unit of power, I have to pay whatever the marginal private cost of producing that first unit of power is, which is what we've thought about so far throughout the class. But now, in addition to that first unit's worth of private cost of labor and capital, I am imposing upon society $4 worth of damages. Kids coughing, old ladies walking more slowly, old gentlemen clearly walking more slowly too, acidic rain falling upon historical Gothic cathedrals, washing faces off of statues, and tourists not wanting to come to your cities and your statues. Okay? So, all kinds of damages here. So what do you think the overall social marginal costs of producing that first unit of power are? All right, economists understand incentives. So you see this pile of chart, you're like, I'm not going to say anything. I'm going to put that chart. Yeah. Social marginal cost. So the total cost upon society of producing that very first unit is the sum of the private marginal cost of producing that unit plus the external cost of that unit. So we simply add this to that and we get a social marginal cost curve. That's private plus external. And that social marginal cost curve is essentially the sum of the private marginal cost curve plus the external marginal cost. Now, what do you think the optimal, meaning the socially optimal amount of power produced is? Yes. So it's not where private marginal cost meets demand, but it's where social marginal cost meets demand. So let's do this. Social marginal cost meets demand. Q double star, or maybe we should give it a little heart, because it's the environmentally right thing to do, and this also gets a little heart right here, right? This is where, from society's perspective, we think we want to be, or at least Max says we want to be there. He still has to show that we want to be there. So if Max is actually right here, and we actually want to be at P heart, Q heart, instead of P star, Q star, then companies left alone in the presence of an externality are going to produce more than is socially optimal, Q star is greater than Q heart, and they're going to charge a price that's too low, they should be charging a higher price. So what Max has to do next is he has to convince me, using one of his fancy welfare tables, that there is deadweight loss from producing Q star instead of producing Q heart. So let's try and do that. If I can find my welfare table. I rearranged my lecture notes, which is always bad. Oh, here it is. Okay, so let's do a welfare table. I'm going to erase these gray things. I also didn't want to put these online, so you got some benefit of coming to class today trying to figure out what the grays are. Okay, so let's do this. What I'm going to want to figure out is, I want to figure out what consumer surplus is the producer surplus. I'll tell you what these things are in a second. The externality cost and total welfare. I'll give you all finals where you have these questions on there, so you'll get some chance to practice this. But the basic idea is as follows. We check out, start with Q heart. Now let's check, what did I start with? Yeah, Q heart. And then Q star. And then the change. So the basic idea is as follows. You take consumer surplus, right? How much benefit consumers get from consumption. Then I'm going to add to it private producer surplus, which is the producer surplus that we've thought about so far, namely how much producers are willing to accept to produce that first unit versus how much they actually get for it, so the difference between price and marginal cost or supply. And then I have to account for the fact that in this society, because producers produce an output that causes damage or imposes a cost upon society, I somehow have to subtract that from overall welfare. Right? Because these power plants are producing this nasty stuff, and by producing this nasty stuff, they're making some part of society, the little kids and the older folks, worse off. So I have to account for that in my welfare calculation. So what I've got here is consumer surplus, private producer surplus, and the externality cost, which is lost. You could think of it as lost consumer surplus from folks who are suffering from the production activity of this firm. All right, so let's do this. How are we going to do this? This is one of these non-obvious pictures. For those of you who actually did what I told you 1-7 lectures ago, where I showed you that there's been weight loss when you're producing little, and then I asked you to do it at home when you're producing too much, if you did that, you're going to like this picture because it looks very similar. What I'm going to show you is that if I produce right here, that's the social optimum, and under perfect competition, we're pushing beyond the social optimum, so we're producing too much. So you're going to get a very similar picture to that little homework assignment I gave you. Okay, so the pizza slices you want are A, this triangle right here, B, which is this area right here, C is going to be this little triangle, D, the little triangle right next to it, E is this triangle right here, F, this triangle right here, G, a weird looking thing. This area right here, and then H is this little area right here. Okay, so let's do it. At Q heart, the consumer surplus is, well, Q heart, P heart, it's the area above price, to the left of quantity, below demand, so it's A. Private producer surplus, or producer surplus like we've called it so far, is the area above supply, meaning the firm's marginal cost curve, or private supply here. So it's the area above supply, to the left of quantity, below price. So it is B, C, F, and G. Okay, that's private producer surplus. Now we get to the hard part. What's total damage from this production activity, or what's the total external cost? Well, the easiest way to figure it out is to just say, well, Max told me that this is the marginal external cost, this curve right here. So for the first unit, the area under this curve tells me the total cost, external cost of producing that first unit. If I produce a second unit, the total cost, external cost of producing that second unit, is simply the area under the curve right here. For the third unit, It's the area between 2 and 3 under the third unit. So total external costs is simply the area under the marginal external cost curve to the left of quantity. Much like total variable costs were just the area under the regular cost. Right? Now you're panicking. Now Max shaded this area. Should on an exam I draw a shaded area and then in here just fill in a little shaded area and the GSI would understand that this is what I should be doing? No. Alright? So let's think about this. There's a geometric trick here. I know that social marginal cost is simply private marginal cost plus external marginal cost. Okay? So the distance between the social marginal cost and the private marginal cost right here is exactly the distance between zero and the marginal external cost curve right here. If I go to another quantity, 2 right here, the distance between the total, the social marginal cost curve and the private marginal cost curve, these two right here, is exactly the distance between the x-axis and the marginal external cost curve. So at any point here, I could measure how far apart the marginal external cost curve and the x-axis are. I could go up here and I would get the exact same distance. This is by construction. What this gets me is that this shaded area right here is exactly the same as, I'm going to shade it a tiny little bit. This is easier in PowerPoint because you have this transparency option. Right? This shaded area right here and this shaded area right here are the exact same, just by construction. So total external cost of producing P hart right here is simply going to be C plus G. Again, upon first inspection, I would never expect you to see that right away, but now that you've seen it, started thinking about it, and you do a couple of practice exams, I would expect you to be able to get that. Okay? So C plus G is total external cost. These two things here are benefits, right? Consumers happy, producers happy. These two right here are bad things for society since people can't breathe. Lots of sales of albuterol because of this. Alright, so minus C plus G. So total external costs are a negative thing. So welfare is going to be consumer surplus plus private producer surplus minus whatever the damage of production from production is. So it's going to be A plus B plus C plus F plus G minus C minus G. So it's going to be A plus B plus F. That's going to be total welfare under the what I'm going to tell you is the socially optimal level of production. Now let's see what the cost and what total welfare is if we left these firms alone and they would just produce Q star. What they would go ahead and do. Alright, you ready for it? Q star is the relevant quantity, P star is the relevant price. So consumer surplus is going to be the area above price, to the left of quantity, below demand. So it's going to be A, B, C, and D. I have been thinking about working a Jackson 5 routine into this because there's always this A, B, C thing, but then my wife told me that that is so cheesy, don't do it. You're going to lose their respect if you haven't already. Okay. So A, B, C, and D is consumer surplus. Producer surplus is the area above supply or marginal cost. So the left of the equilibrium quantity below P star right here. So it's going to be F, G, and H. Did I get that right? Yeah, I did get that right. Now what's the total external cost? Now we're producing more than a Q hart, right? So before total external cost was the area under the marginal cost curve up to Q hart. Now it's going to be the area under the marginal external cost curve up to Q star. It's going to be this whole area right here. Or, if I look again, since the distance here, again, is just going to be the distance right here, it's the area between the social marginal cost curve and the social private cost, it's the area between the social marginal cost curve and the private marginal cost curve, between zero and however much you produce. So in addition to just having this little area right here, it's going to be all of that. So it's going to be, since it's a negative thing, minus g minus c minus d minus h minus e. All right, so let's figure out what total welfare is. Consumers get A, B, C, D. Producers get F, G, H. Overall, as society, we lose G, we lose C, we lose D, we lose H, and we lose E. So total welfare is going to be A plus B plus F minus E. So the difference between Q star welfare and Q hart welfare is minus E. So this little triangle right here, E, that is the deadweight loss of having a firm which imposes a negative externality upon society produce what it finds privately optimal. Right? The firm produces too much. It produces Q star when it's socially optimal to produce Q hart. Now I dare you to go home and see what happens if the firm produces less than Q hart. What you'll also see is there'll be a deadweight loss. So you can't find a quantity of production that gets you a higher overall level of welfare than Q hart. Excellent question. If I may, let me just finish how you do it with the. Let me just show you what the practice is, and then I'll quickly go to the positive externality.
Just quickly, if you're ready to put this in your externalities for the.
Oh, yeah, that's right. So either I get rid of the brackets, or I turn this into pluses. Right? So, yeah, absolutely right. So it's not minus minus. Question?
Maybe this is a dumb question, but.
Okay.
Let's say that the externality doesn't appear to be certain quantity. So your social marginal cost doesn't start the same place as your external cost. So you said G factor.
Yeah. So yeah, it gets a little bit trickier. So what you're asking. That's the day before Thanksgiving. I don't have that much more to talk about, so let's do these two things you just asked. Let me do the positive externality first, and then your quick one. All right? So positive externality means, and you'll get a chance to practice this on the practice exam. Well, if we have supply, which again is the private marginal cost, and you have demand, this would be Q star, which is what the firms produce when they're left alone, and this is what P star would be. Now, a positive externality means if this firm produces, society overall gets some sort of kickback, right? Society gets a kickback from having a beekeeper keep bees. So what happens here is that the marginal cost of production is actually a marginal benefit of production. The marginal external cost is in some sense actually a marginal external benefit that society is better off. So a benefit is just a negative cost. So the marginal external cost curve is negative, right? So whereas you produce more output, you get more benefit, which is just a negative cost. And the social marginal cost curve. Again, it's just private marginal cost plus private external cost. So you add a negative number to a positive number, which basically just shifts down. The supply curve, right? Where again the distance between the private cost curve and the social cost curve is exactly the distance between these two. Let me just finish that and I'll get to you in 1 second. So what that means is the optimal output level, Q heart and P heart, are we're producing too little of goods that cause a positive externality, and we're charging a price that is too high, right? So we should produce more bees and charge a lower price for bees since they get us delicious apples that we then turn into apple cider for Thanksgiving. So that's the case for a positive externality. Again, there's a question on the practice exam. What Mike, asked is the following. What if you have a supply curve, you have a demand curve with this private marginal cost curve, and your marginal external cost doesn't increase immediately, right? You get a certain freebie where at low levels of production, there is no damage, but at higher levels of production, something happens. There are a bunch of pollutants we think about actually happen like this. You put warm water into rivers, small increases in water temperature don't seem to do much for fish. But as soon as you reach a certain threshold, all of a sudden fish start dying or they can't swim, stuff like that. So the idea here is there's no marginal external cost up until a certain level, and then it goes up. So what would that social marginal cost curve look like? Again, just add them, right? So up to here, if I add social external costs and private costs, it's just the private costs. But as soon as I reach this output level right here, I'm going to have to start adding in these positive external costs, and I get this kink. So marginal cost, social. So again, the prediction is the same, that in the private setting, you would produce Q star and P star, and the socially optimal amount is Q heart and P heart, where, again, the socially optimal output should be lower and the price should be higher than what we would see firms do if they were left alone. Now, the question that you really ask is, if you made me do welfare here, is there an easy way to draw this? There kind of is, but I wouldn't be this mean to you. Right, but the key insight here is that the area under the marginal external cost curve is always the distance between these two. So if I looked at how big this triangle is right here, the area right here is exactly equal to that area right here. So you could figure it out, but that would be a pretty mean question. I've already asked you to, so I think I might have read it. Okay. So that's externalities right there. So externalities are bad. Positive and negative externalities cause a deadweight loss in the sense that there is deadweight loss from having produced too little in the case of a positive externality and too much in the case of a negative externality. Question?
You didn't finish adding up the welfare of the part.
I didn't?
On the change part?
Oh, okay. So right here at Q star, consumers get B, C, and D in addition to having A before. Producers, they have F and G. They gain H. Sorry, they gain H, but they lose B, and they lose C, and society as a whole loses D, H, and E. So the reason I didn't really go through that here, because it's not quite clear who who this externality cost accrues to, right? That really depends upon what type of externality we're talking to. Does it affect just consumers, or does it affect other producers? So if this is an externality cost where the pollutant affects the fishery downstream, you wouldn't take it out of consumer surplus, right? You would potentially take it out of the other producers. So it's kind of tricky to say, you know, consumers really gain here and producers potentially lose because it's not quite sure. We're not quite sure who we should attribute this to. So it's a big battle in courts then to figure out who loses. But let me just sum this up and then let's go how to get society or firms to actually produce the optimal output level. So welfare is maximized where price or demand is equal to social marginal cost. Right? At Q hearts and P hearts. So the point where economists or environmental economists like myself get ourselves in trouble all the time is what this picture says here is the socially optimal level of pollution is less than what firms would produce privately. What this picture doesn't say is that the optimal level of pollution is zero. Now there are a lot of I wouldn't call them extremes, but rather outspoken environmental groups which argue that the optimal level of pollution should be zero. We have no right to put pollutants into the environment. We're guests on this planet, and therefore, why do we, you know, produce power and pollute the environment? It's an interesting argument. What an economist would argue here is you have to trade off the benefits from consuming power to the costs of producing that power. So we should trade off how much it costs us to produce that last unit of power from society's perspective, taking into account all the costs of producing that power, including the value of damaging the environment, and trade that off against the benefits from consuming that power. We get benefits from consuming power. I mean, in our cases, it's, you know, high-speed connections and PlayStation 3. But, you know, we're sort of in a weird spectrum of the income distribution. But if you're looking at, you know, rural households, the ability to have an electric light in your hut allows you to study longer, read longer, kids do better in school. It allows you to cook, not burning tires. I don't know if anyone here listened to this NPR thing yesterday about Afghanistan's rural households, where apparently now there are these dealers that are shipping tires into Afghanistan, and households, because times are so rough, are burning tires inside huts in order to cook and heat. There are few things that are more dangerous to children's health than burning rubber indoors. It's really a really, really terrible thing to do. So I found that really, really boring. One person that studies these issues here is Kirk Smith. He's the world expert on indoor air pollution. Kirk Smith is a good person to talk to. But the big song and dance that environmental economists do before congressional committees, in textbooks and in classes such as this one, is that the private market, firms left alone, when there are externalities in the production process, they will fail to reach the society optimal line. Right? They'll either produce too much or too little. So in order to get from Q star, which is what firms produce if they're left alone, to Q heart, what we need is, ta-da, government intervention. Yes, tax is exactly the right answer. All right? So let's see how we do that. It's really easy. It's so easy that you're going to stand there and say, why doesn't anybody just get this? All right, so government intervention comes in two flavors. It actually comes in 17 and a half different flavors, not all of which are very different from each other. But two general flavors. One flavor is to say that you use so-called price incentives, where you charge firms a tax or a per unit fee or an effluent charge. All of those words are taxes, right? Politically, effluent charge is much more easily sellable than the word tax. Tax is not something that politicians like. standards is the other approach, where instead of charging firms for their production activity, you actually just tell them how much they can produce. So you could go in and tell this paper mill or power plant, you simply have to produce Q hard, you cannot produce Q star. Both of those have issues. Question?
What about forcing producers to clean up?
That's exactly what a standard would do. Right? So it would just set the output at exactly Q hard. Right? Again, the underlying assumption here is that there's no magic machinery that you could install in order to clean up your act, which is a whole other issue. If you want to study this stuff in detail, I can point out 14 classes that you should take. I did, and I loved it. Okay, so taxes. How can we use a tax in order to get firms to produce at the right level? I could draw it into this picture, but it's already messy. So let me draw it into a separate picture. Okay, just a quick sketch here. Demand, supply, marginal external costs. This is what firms produce when they're left alone. And I want firms to produce social marginal costs. I want the firm to produce right here. So what do we know about taxes? If I charge a firm a specific tax, does it produce more or less? If it produces less, what do I want here? Do I want the firm to produce more or less? Less, right? So a tax seems to do exactly what I want it to do. What does a specific tax do to the supply curve? So if I charge these firms each $1 to produce one unit of power, how much does the supply curve shift up by? $1. Right? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to charge these firms a tax that shifts the supply curve up exactly. Oops. It's not king. All right? I'm going to shift the supply curve up by tau units, tau dollars per unit, until I get to a point where this new supply curve, F plus tau, intersects the demand curve exactly at P hard, Q hard. So the way to get firms to produce the optimal output level, which is Q hard, we simply charge a firm the tax that's exactly equal to the marginal external cost at the optimal output level, right? So if you look at the distance between these two right here, if I would have drawn this to scale, that would be exactly the distance between the x-axis and the marginal external cost. So the tax is exactly equal to the marginal external cost at the optimal output level. Now that's easy, right? Max now showed me something that would solve all of our climate problems, all of our air pollution problems, everything that's wrong with the world, and when I look outside that makes me sad, the tax would fix it. Well, yes, it would. But there are a couple of major wrinkles to taxes. The first thing, what you need to know in order to set this tax optimally, you need to know what social marginal cost is. Right? This picture assumed that you know exactly how much damage each additional unit does. And this is what your colleague pointed out in row 2 here earlier, as well, that's a nice picture, Max, but how do I know what these actual numbers are? So what environmental economists do is we spend a lot of time figuring out how much people are willing to pay in order to avoid pollution. So there are lots and lots of methods. I'll talk about this a little bit next time. On how to estimate this, but the general idea is it's very, very hard. Second, we don't know what demand is usually. We have a rough idea, but in order to figure out what the optimal amount is, we know how much, what demand is at each level of price. In addition, we need to know exactly how much pollution comes from each firm and each level of output in order to figure out how to attribute that that pollution. For power plants, we know that, exactly how much pollution comes from each firm. For barbecue restaurants, which are huge emitters of volatile organic compounds, we don't know that. If we were able to figure all of that out and we wanted to put in place a standard or a tax, we would have to be able to actually enforce that tax or that standard. So even if we know what's best for us, which in the case of climate change, we know what's best for us, pretty sure, try and push through a carbon tax in Congress or in the California legislature. Good luck to you. Taxes are politically completely infeasible, even though most economists will tell you that they're the efficient thing to do. Income taxes, not efficient. Pollution taxes, very efficient. So an economist's favorite sci-fi novel is one where people drive their cars, they're paid per mile, they pay a little fee for driving the car, sort of per mile tax. They're paying for activities that cause pollution and, you know, playing Celine Dion records that their neighbors have to suffer from, and they pay no income. So I wish you a very happy holiday. I see you next Tuesday. I'll give you two more lessons.